I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, new details on the suspicious letters that shut down multiple election offices in Washington. Plus, should the history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine be taught in our public schools? And on that note, we'll discuss reason number 1,964,354, why educators should stop inserting their personal political opinions into everything. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, this is a people-powered podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can do that for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We'll get to some of the latest election results just momentarily. It is election week, after all, in Washington, where every single day we've got to update you on results because we don't have finalized results sometimes for days or even weeks. But I want to do a follow-up to a story that was developing during the show yesterday, and that was when we started to hear that all these election offices, King County, Pierce County, over in Spokane County, were being evacuated because of a suspicious letter that had showed up to each of them. We still, and I'll be clear, there's still a lot we don't know about what happened. However, before I get to the comment from the Secretary of State's office, our friend Ari Hoffman, I think, was the first one to break this morning. He actually obtained a picture of the letter that was at least sent to the Pierce County Elections Office. And I will say, I have a lot to say about the letter. I don't mean to make light of the situation. This is clearly serious. Anyone who would do this intentionally disrupt the ballot counting process. I mean, in Spokane County, they said they were going to skip an entire day of releasing election results. So it did have an impact. It's incredibly serious. It probably scared the hell out of people at the elections offices when they opened up this letter and there was a white powdery substance in there. But I'll just point out a couple things again about the particular letter that showed up in Pierce County. It read, "End elections now. Stop giving power to the right that they don't have. We are in charge now, and there is no more need for them. Also, be aware your ballot drops are very susceptible to noxious chemicals like AMBL. They are unsafe to the public. Just saying." And then it has not only an Antifa, I think it's an anti-fascist sign. It has the trans flag, and it has what I think is a pentagram, I'm pretty sure. And then the letter looks like it was postmarked out of Portland. And it was sent by, the sender name is Mike Hawk. Okay. So clearly we're dealing with a very mature and a very sophisticated criminal here. And I'm going to bounce back and forth between completely making fun of this and taking it seriously. Here's the thing. I think there were a lot of conservatives who jumped onto this letter and they're like, this is the left wing trying to disrupt our elections. Honestly, I tend to think that this is someone trying to make it seem like it's the left wing. It's got all the Jussie Smollett vibes, you know, where Jussie Smollett said some guys in Make America Great Again hats attacked him in downtown Chicago and yelled, "This is MAGA country." And I'm like, sure, bro, that definitely happened. And I just think that this letter is trying way too hard to make it look like it came from some left wing lunatics who are Trantifa devil worshippers. So anyway, regardless, whether it came from, I wouldn't put it past a lunatic on the left to send it, but whether it came from a loon on the left or a loon on the right who wanted to make us believe that it came from a loon on the left, I hope they get to the bottom of it, because it is serious. It disrupted things. It further politicizes the elections process. And I got to say, it's just the absolute last thing that we need right now. The Secretary of State's office did put out a press release, and we hadn't heard from him yesterday during the show, and so I do want to read it. He said, envelopes received by elections offices in King, Pierce, Skagit, and Spokane counties were found Wednesday to contain unknown powdery substances. Each impacted county's election workers evacuated their offices, and election leaders have taken precautions to keep employees and office visitors safe. Local, state, and federal authorities are investigating the incidents, which occurred while workers were processing ballots from the November 7th general election. Because investigations are ongoing, the Office of the Secretary of State can provide no further information about the incidents. It says Secretary of State Steve Hobbs said these incidents illustrate the need to take seriously the threats that elections workers face in administering Washington's democratic process. He said the safety of staff and observers is paramount as election workers across the state open envelopes and count each voter's ballot. These incidents underscore the critical need for stronger protections for all election workers. Democracy rests upon free and fair elections. These incidents are acts of terrorism to threaten our election. And I certainly agree with that. And frankly, you know, there's this back and forth like, oh, this is right wing, left wing. And people were just salivating. The fringes were just salivating yesterday, hoping that they could blame the other side for this. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, people have absolutely lost it. Not a surprise that stuff like this happens when people have become so vitriolic and just absolutely digging into their fringe positions. So I'm hoping that federal law enforcement can figure out who did this. It sounds like at least one or more had, and again, I'm going to go back between laughing about this and taking it seriously. One or more of the letters had residual fentanyl traces, to which I thought, well, King County Metro told us that that's not dangerous. So, but it doesn't surprise me if any letter sent from Portland, Oregon would have fentanyl traces on it. But it didn't sound like the powdery substance itself was like anthrax or a big thing of fentanyl. So we'll wait for more information. I hope they found this person and they send them to federal prison. It absolutely is an act that's meant to disrupt elections and meant to create and deepen divides. At the end of the day, regardless of what fringe lunatic sent this, because you do have to be a little cuckoo to send this and to put the name Mike Hawk on it. But, you know, they belong in prison and it only serves to deepen the divisions that already exist. So a little update on that for you. While we're at it, there were some counties that were still able to update election results. King County still got some updated election results out despite what was happening. I do still believe that Spokane said they were just skipping yesterday and then they were going to update results. So the mayor's race in Spokane, we're not going to update today because it hasn't changed from yesterday when we talked to you. But a few things have changed. So let's start with Snohomish County. The race for sheriff, which, you know, we care a lot about. I would really like to see if Sheriff Adam Fortney, who's done a good job on public safety, keep his job. Now, the percentages are still more or less the same because we round the percentages. Adam Fortney is 48%. His challenger, 52%. I will say, however, that he did close the gap a little bit. And in the latest ballot drop, he picked up an additional 500 votes to close the gap. But he needs about roughly 55%, maybe a little more, of all the remaining ballots. There's about 50,000 ballots left to count in Snohomish County. If you presume that everyone who turned in one of those ballots probably voted in the sheriff's race, and then you look at the numbers, he needs just over 55%. Of the remaining ballots need to fall in his direction. That's quite a swing. Not impossible, but it's quite a swing. So I'm really looking forward to the ballot drops today to see if there's a substantial late swing for Adam Fortney. All right, quickly in the city of Seattle, we are still seeing every incumbent trailing in their races, which is a good thing. Although, particularly in District 6, the Ballard area, I think Dan Strauss is going to keep his job. I now believe Dan Strauss is going to keep his job. He's got 49% of the vote. Pete Hanning has 50% of the vote, but that's closed a little bit from the last update that we gave you. And so if that trajectory continues for Dan Strauss, it seems like he would narrowly keep his seat. In District 2, Tammy Morales still trails. Are these updated, Nicole? 46%, 54%? Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot. That's updated. So for some reason, I thought she close the gap. Just can you double check on that for me? But that's what we have in District 2 with Tammy Morales. I do know she's still behind. I just want to make sure that those percentages are accurate as of right now. And in District 7, Andrew Lewis is still losing to Bob Kettle. You said yes, those are still updated. Andrew Lewis is still losing to Bob Kettle. I don't think that this is a hole that Andrew Lewis is going to be able to dig himself out of. But we're going to wait. We're going to wait and see what happens today at 4 p.m. and see how extreme the swings are, particularly in Tammy Morales's race, because Shama Sawant is the, I guess, the closest measure we have of how much of a deficit someone of her political persuasion can come back from. And I think the largest deficit with her was 12 points. And so Tammy Morales is within that, and she is Shama Sawant adjacent in terms of her politics. And so we'll see what happens there, but a few updates. Speaking of the election, I've said that I think public safety is the absolute most important thing. And for every vote I took that had to do with a position that would have any sort of hand in public safety, that's what it was about for me, is what are they saying about public safety? What is their plan, et cetera? And that's particularly important in Seattle. Seattle's down 600 cops. How do you patrol a city? How do you proactively try to fight crime? How do you even respond to life or death emergencies when you're down 600 cops? And a lot of that is because of the political climate. We know that. We know that that's what officers have been saying who've left for other agencies. We've interviewed some of them on our show. In the summer of 2020, the downright vilification of officers took a toll, and there's no way around that. And so, yeah, you can put a bunch of pro-public safety, which it's funny that we have to say pro-public safety, because, I hate that some people are actually, in my opinion, anti-public safety. But you could put a bunch of these more moderate council members on the council, and they can put forth laws that will strengthen the ability of Seattle police officers to go out and fight crime, but are there enough officers to actually fight that crime? So coming up this week on our subscriber, Sundays with Subscribers, our exclusive show just for subscribers that airs every week, we have Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz joining us to talk about what a new council would mean for his department. There have been a lot of officers who have left because of the political climate. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact. They write it down in black and white when they decide to leave. So when you're looking at really what I would characterize as a desperate situation with police staffing, how much does it help if you wind up with a city council where the majority of members are very supportive of the work you're doing?
Can you say that again?
Yeah. How much does it help to have council members who don't hate cops?
Well, you know, it extremely helps. I mean, right now, our officers are paying attention to every city council race. They're paying attention to, people's values and just understanding of what they are standing for and what they say. And so that is important. And I think even as I look at new recruits that come into the department, one of the things, when I came into the office in 97, I had knew nothing about my city council. I didn't pay attention to who the mayor was, didn't pay attention to any of that. But our new recruits are paying attention. They're paying attention to elections. They're paying attention to every aspect of the political environment.
Well, and it's a lot more kind of, I would say, spastic than it used to be, decades ago. You had political disagreements, but it wasn't this level of, I would say, insanity that we've seen kind of in the last few years. So how hard is that, though, for your officers to be so much at the whim of the changing ideologies on the city council? Because you look back, were you deputy chief in 2020?
For a month.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And then you became the interim chief. That was an interesting period for you too. But you look at really what was a lot of anti-police animus during that time. And then you fast forward 3 years and you've got voters who are putting people who've been very supportive of law enforcement on the city council. Is that hard as a police officer and as a police chief to navigate the changing desires of the politicians in charge?
Very much so. I mean, everyone has a certain political structure that they're trying to get votes for, and you're paying attention to every aspect of that. So, I've been communicating with all the city council since 2020 when I took over, and a lot of adjustments, just even within themselves. I mean, from 2020, it was discussions of budget cuts, and we had COVID cuts that are already created part of the largest mid-year cut that we've ever experienced, loss of staffing. And so you have to, and then trying to recruit officers, try to navigate the recruitment, but also try to navigate all of the other things that keep officers in the job. And so to now get into an election where everybody's talking about public safety and everybody in the mayor is really pushing for, this is our number one charter. It is public safety. And as a city, we have to create those investments and pushing us to make sure that we're cleaning up certain areas of the city, such as 12th and Jackson and 3rd and Pine, and other areas, because we've seen an increase in violent crimes over the last couple of years.
And so that full conversation with Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz is airing this week on Sundays with Subscribers. If you'd like to subscribe for $5 a month, you can catch all of those episodes on DividedPod.com. We talk not only, of course, about the current elections and what's happening, but we also discussed, what did I ask him, Nicole? I asked him about the legacy of Shama Sawant. He gave the most diplomatic answer to what is the legacy of Shama Sawant. We also talked about the enforcement of this new drug bill, the drug possession bill that they've been out there enforcing, and whether that's actually going to make a difference in what's happening on the streets. That interview with Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz coming up this Sunday on Sundays with Subscribers. All right, after the break, should public schools in our state teach kids about the long history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine? We'll discuss it with the Republican leader in the state Senate, John Braun, who's crafting a bill to do just that. But first, if you are considering putting your home on the market, you want to know if it's well positioned, obviously, to be able to get the most money for it. I mean, I think that's what everybody cares about when they decide to put their home on the market. Wes Jones with sellwithwes.com, he's been telling us that actually home prices have been ticking up despite some of the other economic factors like interest rates. And he explained why.
We should be experiencing not necessarily a crash, but we should be seeing a reduction in purchase price. When you have interest rates jump up by, you know, nearly 40% in over a 12-month time span, that should be compressing pricing, but we're actually seeing the opposite. Prices have come up about 5% since the beginning of the year. And overall transaction count is down, just meaning less houses overall are selling, but they're still selling pretty quickly because there's been a lot of pent up demand, you know, over time. So, it's going pretty well, but in general, there are not enough homes on the market to meet demand.
Yeah, so if you're thinking about putting your home on the market, reach out to Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com, ask them for a free market analysis so he can talk about how your home is positioned in the area, in the neighborhood, given the economic factors involved. And then from there, you can also use their Listing Boost concierge service if perhaps you need to make some updates to your home before it hits the market. And I'd start by using their home value calculator at sellwithwes.com. Plug in your address, find out how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, we know that there's a lot going on when it comes to not only what's happening, obviously, in the Middle East, but how it's being discussed in America, how it's being discussed by protesters on the streets, how it's being discussed in institutions of higher education. And I'd really like to know how teachers in Washington State are discussing it with their kids, because I'm sorry, but there is a track record of a lot of activism in our public schools. And so God only knows what kind of conversations are happening when it comes to Palestine, Israel, and the rhetoric that has been happening, certainly in politics in the U.S. And so it was interesting. We got an email from Senator John Braun. He's the Republican leader in the Senate. And his office had reached out and said, hey, you know, we're contemplating, we're crafting a bill right now that would actually improve the way the Holocaust is taught in our public schools, but would also look at teaching kids about the history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine. So perhaps they will be more informed about it and less susceptible to believe some of these extreme narratives about it. So we invited Senator John Braun on the show to talk about this effort. Senator Braun, welcome back to Undivided.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're already working on stuff for the session, one would hope. But this particular proposal that you're crafting right now has to do with K through 12 education and really trying to deal with some of the rising anti-Semitism that we're seeing through helping kids better understand history. So just talk first about the genesis of why you feel like this is necessary.
But I think it's pretty clear from what we've seen over the last few weeks that we're not getting through. People are not understanding that 7 million Jews were killed during the Holocaust. You know, that's a staggering number. I don't think people get that. You know, the idea that they can say, well, you know, or try to put it in context. You can't put something like that in context. You have to take it for what it is, and you have to do everything you can to make sure we don't do that sort of thing again. And I think I got concerns. I think many have concerns that we are headed in the wrong direction. So, again, one of the things we can do is to give our children a better understanding through our K-12 education system of what happened and how it happened, and therefore hope for prevent it from happening or something like that from happening in the future.
Yeah. How do you, as you go about trying to craft a bill that would reflect what you think should be happening at K-12 schools, how do you begin to craft something that I guess would do a better job? I mean, who are you consulting to determine, you know, what the curriculum is now versus what improvements could be made?
So it started basically a few weeks ago with an idea. What, you know, understanding what's the curriculum right now? Where is it not, you know, not been effective? And who do we talk to get a better understanding? So there's a whole bunch of folks from, you know, from the from Jewish organizations and associations here in the state of Washington to national organizations to the General Consul for Israel in the West. You know, there's a lot of folks, as you might imagine, who are thinking about this. That we see not a rise in anti-Semitism, not just in our state, but across the country and to a certain extent around the world. So there are, you know, good people have thought about this. So we're reaching out to literally anybody that you know wants to look at our idea and give us constructive feedback. I don't think we're there yet. I mean, because we want, but that's why we're starting. We got a little bit of time before session. We want to get as much input as we can, make a common sense bill that will make a real difference in getting the type of education I believe that our children need and deserve, having to do with Holocaust.
Yeah, and frankly, even if this bill, you know, regardless of what happens to the bill, I think this is probably a pretty good time in history to reevaluate how we're teaching the Holocaust to kids in general and the current curriculum that exists and constantly be looking at ways to improve it. You know, So that kind of teaches you, you know, obviously the horrors that Jewish people have suffered through history. But when we talk about the current conflict and what's going on, do you believe that, you know, 70 years of conflict between Israel and Palestine is something that ought to be taught to kids in grade school?
Well, I mean, I want to be clear. This is a curriculum for K through 12. So I'm not sure all of this fits into grade school. I mean, there's some very graphic things that I think we need to be careful about. But yeah, I think that folks understanding how we got to the situation we are, understanding the facts of, because there's a lot of, you know, say, indoctrination in some parts of our education system that I don't think are based on the facts. How did the state of Israel come to exist? What has been the source of conflict over all these years? And how can it be resolved? I mean, the idea put forth often by folks who are showing up to protest that we need to eliminate the state of Israel. That's, of course, in my view, wrongheaded. But you know, it's also, you know, the idea that they can say that and say, and I don't doubt some of them are saying in good faith, but say it and not believe, that leads to further conflict, to further destruction, to further violence. It's just, you know, short-sighted. We have gotten to this point in our world where we sort of have one standard for the state of Israel and one standard for everyone else, and that's not right. We have to get down to the facts, get down to the real history. And I think if we do that, I want to be clear, there's good and bad in that history. We should teach all of it. If we're gonna learn from it, we gotta teach all of it. But the notion that we're somehow going to solve the problem by simply eliminating the state of Israel is just not wrong-headed. And I'd say morally wrong, but also very dangerous.
Yeah, and I tend to think, just my opinion, that 80% of the people who've been out there protesting this pro-Hamas message probably could not point to Jerusalem on a map or articulate any of the history whatsoever. That's just my personal opinion. But I also want to clarify, I didn't mean to suggest that we should be teaching these kids to elementary schoolers or middle schoolers, but I think the conversation around what are high schoolers equipped to deal with. But one of my other concerns when we talk about something like this, so clearly this has become politicized. Clearly, this has been become something that activists have globbed onto. So how do you prevent that activism from seeping into how this conflict would be taught in high schools?
Yeah, I think that you're latched on to, I think, one of the key challenges we have is you go to all this effort and to get, you know, to provide the facts, the basis, the resources, the professional training for teachers. And then if you end up with an activist teacher, do they teach something different regardless of what the input is? I think that's a real concern and one we're going to have to wrestle with. I'm not going to sit here and claim I have the answer to that, but we are aware of that challenge. That is something we have to fight back on. And we have to, and it's true, certainly in this area where we're focused on right now, but it's true, you know, across the board in our teaching system is we got to get back to the fundamentals of education. Stop trying to have teachers impart their bias on children. Let's teach them not what to think, but how to think, as they say. And I think if we do that, we'll have a much better outcome.
Yeah, it's tough. And I see both sides of this. It's one of the things that would lead me to be a little concerned about this bill, because if they're not already teaching the history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine in our high schools, and then you insert that into it right now, no doubt you're going to have teachers who want to teach it their own way. And now this presents an opportunity for them to do so. So I'll be interested to see what you guys come up with. Do you think that this is something you could get some bipartisan support on?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I mean, I know there are folks on both sides of the aisle who are deeply concerned about the growth in anti-Semitism in our state, and I think they're genuine in that concern. And whether this is the right answer, we have a couple other legislative ideas we're working on. One is simply to define anti-Semitism. There's a very robust international definition. I think Washington could benefit by adopting that definition. So that's another idea that's out there, maybe a little less controversial, a little straightforward. Start with the basics. And the other thing we're working on, and this is not necessarily related to education, was the idea of, we've seen some very disturbing, threats of violence against Jewish schools and associations. Can we offer assistance from the state to make sure that they're well protected, that we don't have folks living in a dangerous situation? So we're looking at a number of different things to get after the broader problem. And we're open to other ideas. This book isn't closed. I think the most important thing we can do right now is to try to reach a common understanding and, to your point, hopefully a bipartisan understanding of the threat and the risk to not just to the state of Israel, but to our society if we let this continue.
Well, I'm sure Bob Ferguson will be reaching out to you about his extremism commission, right? To look into acts of anti-Semitism, not just right-wing extremism, or no?
Well, I haven't heard from Bob yet on this issue, so we'll see. My mind's certainly open, but I'm not waiting.
Yeah, do me a favor. Don't hold your breath. All right, Senator John Braun, we appreciate your time.
All right.
Yeah, so I definitely have some, whenever you put something this controversial in the hands of teachers, a lot of those teachers will do a good job. The vast majority of teachers, I think, are following the curriculum and they're not inserting their personal political bias into anything that's happening. But there are a lot who are. And especially given the toxic nature of this thing, how do you regulate that? How do you keep teachers from crossing the line? That's what I'd be really curious about. And that is also why I made this the subject of our daily subscriber show poll, to get some of your thoughts on it. And I imagine that you guys are certainly going to mimic some of the opinions that I had on it. The question, should Washington's K-12 curriculum include lessons on the history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine? And I ask that specifically because I'm not so concerned about taking a second look at how the Holocaust is taught. That's already being taught to kids in public schools in Washington State. And I don't think that you see as many crazy sentiments about the Holocaust as you do, of course, about what's happening between Israel and Palestine. So right now, the vast majority of you are saying yes, although some of you are skeptical. We'll leave this poll open for subscribers on Patreon and Locals. Jen says yes, if it's factual and not politically based. I think that being the key. Spokane subscriber, I like that. That's very specific. Thank you for telling us where you are. High school, yes. In a history, civics, and or political class, younger kids are too young and should focus on basics. Yeah, I think the complex history between Israel and Palestine and disputed Holy Land, I don't think that that's something that needs to be taught before high school for sure. Vicky said, I would in a world history class because World War II and the Holocaust, that's factual and important history. Yeah, and if you're going to extend World War II and what happened in the Holocaust to what, the creation of Israel as a state and then the resulting conflict, then that's sort of a natural course of events. But yeah, a lot of you have the same opinion that as long as it's facts and not opinion, the real question is, though, how do you regulate that? And do you have a Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction that's willing to regulate that? Do you have school districts who are willing to regulate that? Because I'll tell you what, we have a story coming up today, and unbelievable, that makes me really doubt that some school districts can handle this topic appropriately. Everyone watching this right now has insurance, I would hope, because there's some things you have to have insurance on. So if you don't tell anybody, or we're going to have a conversation about that. But I have been preaching First Mark Insurance because I just think it's local. It's veteran-owned, and they've been doing this for a long time. First Mark Insurance costs nothing for you. They get paid by insurance companies, but what they do is you come to them, you take the First Mark challenge, you bring, and look, it's not quick. Mike and I think we had to schedule an hour, maybe even an hour and a half, to do a virtual conversation with them. They took a couple weeks to shop the market for us, but we went to them and said, hey, we'd like to see if we can save some money, but also we know we're woefully underinsured. We're about to merge our lives together. What do you recommend? So they went out, they shopped the market, they brought back what they would recommend, and Mike and I got much better insurance for the same price we were paying already. So it was an absolute no-brainer. Dave Taylor, the CEO of First Mark, says money is important. You know, making sure that you have something that you can afford is important, but they also bring a lot of other things to the table.
We like to talk about there's three elements to a really healthy insurance program. Yeah. It's having the right coverage. It's having the right coverage at a competitive rate, and it's having the service behind it when you need it, right? So all three things are really important. However, people are bombarded with the message of price, right? So when people reach out to us, it's okay that they all pretty much reach out and say, hey, mm-hmm. I want to see if I can save some money.
And can you do it in 15 minutes or less?
Yeah. No. And the answer is no.
No, we can't. Okay. No. Yeah, so don't call First Mark Insurance thinking that they're going to get this all wrapped up in a day. No, it's probably going to take about a month, honestly. Just a little bit of time investment, and they're going to be out busy working on your behalf, and then they're going to come back when they're ready and present you with what they have. But it's a time investment up front. It's going to pay dividends in the long run. The amount of worry that it's taken away from us in terms of, you know, looking at our insurance every year, they're doing all that for you. So check it out, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Take the First Mark Challenge. The best part is they work for you, not the insurance companies. All right, it is just one of those days. We got a double dose of unbelievable today, starting with a school district superintendent who is actually apologizing for an email he sent out condemning the Hamas terror attacks. Let's get to it. Boop. All right, this is an exclusive. You're only going to hear it here on the Undivided Podcast. This is also a follow-up to a story we've been sort of slowly tracking and breaking new tidbits on. So this takes us to the Bainbridge Island School District. And this school district first got on our radar when it comes to speaking out against political and social issues because it was right after the attack happened against Israel. And there was a concerned individual with ties to the district, we'll just say that, who reached out and said, hey, you know, I just got this email basically saying that teachers aren't to take a position on this when this school district has taken positions on all sorts of things. I mean, we went back and looked at emails. They've taken a position on George Floyd, you know, when the verdict came in the George Floyd trial in Minneapolis. When there's been mass shootings across the country, the superintendent of this district has sent out emails to parents and to staff. So it's not as if this is a district that has been completely hands-off when it's like, hey, hot button, political issues, gun control, whatever, social, whatever it is, like, let's just focus on education. No, this district has very much, and the superintendent of this district has very much been vocal when things come up that fit a certain agenda. So anyway, back on October 9th, so this is what, 2 days after the terror attack on Israel, the equity curriculum specialist at the Bainbridge Island School District had sent out an email, and this was internal. My understanding is that this email had just gone to staff. And in it, she cautioned them against saying, she said, this is not time to argue about the politics of the Middle East. And basically said, you know, I'm not going to share my opinion or choose a side. And suggesting that teachers shouldn't either. It's not a time to argue about the politics of the Middle East. The conflict there is longstanding and complex. We all should do our best to understand this history, but this is a long process. And for the whistleblower who sent this to us, they were kind of like, it just seems odd. It seems odd that they're willing to not only take political positions on all these other things, but actively encourage teachers to talk to students about events nationally, about worldwide events that are controversial. But on this, can't take a side against Hamas and terrorism. So we get on the show. I think we got on October 10th, that episode. We came out and we're like, this is ridiculous. And that's the story that we told. Well, the next day, the very next day, after we raised concerns about this, the superintendent of the Bainbridge Island School District sent out an email to staff and to parents condemning the terror attack against Israel, unequivocally saying the cruel and inhumane terrorist attack carried out this past weekend by Hamas has caused deep sadness and heartbreak over the lives lost in the attack on Israel. So at the time, whether it was brought about by us criticizing the school district for suggesting that you can take positions on all these other things, but you can't take a position on the Hamas terror attack. So whether it was brought about by us shaming them, naming them, whatever, we gave this superintendent credit for whatever the reason, coming back, sending out an email a few days after it and saying, unequivocally, this is horrifying. You know, we condemn this. It's cruel and inhumane. So, well, just, you know, color me surprised when in my inbox from the same whistleblower yesterday, I got forwarded another message from that same superintendent who is now apologizing for the previous email condemning Hamas. I'm going to read this for you in full. He sent this out November 8th. Dear Bainbridge Island School District community, several weeks ago, I sent a letter to our school community and expressed my sorrow over the lives lost in Israel on October 7th. The intent of the message was to provide support to members of the local Jewish community who were grieving. However, for some, especially those in the Muslim community, the message made people feel diminished and undervalued. This was not my intention. I apologize. He went on to say, I appreciate those of you who shared how my words impacted you. It was a good reminder that words have the power to both unite and divide us. As I navigate future significant events, I will strive to model for our students how to lead with inquiry, care, and compassion. As adults, children look to us for guidance. Let us demonstrate how to walk together in grace and kindness, assume each other's best intentions, and recognize we each have life experiences that provide us with our own lens in which we view the world. I'm grateful for this community and the learning opportunities it provides, including for your superintendent. Respectfully, Superintendent Peter Bang Knudsen. You have to be kidding me. You were guilted into apologizing for calling a terrorist attack cruel and humane. You were guilted into apologizing for calling a terror attack where innocent people were murdered, raped, beheaded, kidnapped, cruel and humane. Truly, is that what we've come to? If you want to get involved in these political and social issues, which again, this is the exact reason why you shouldn't, because you're always going to offend someone. Sometimes even when you call a terror attack cruel and inhumane, you're going to offend someone. So if you're not willing to take a position that is so obvious, that is so morally correct, if you're not going to be willing to defend it, then you don't do it at all. You know, condemning a terror attack by Hamas is not an insult to Muslims. To suggest it's an insult to Muslims is to suggest that all Muslims are Hamas, which is insane. This is one of the wildest things I've seen come out of a school district. The fact that this superintendent would feel compelled, whatever shame he endured between when he sent this out on October 9th to when he apologized a month later on November 8th, whatever shame he endured or pressure, it is not justification for walking back what is the morally correct position to take. This is really wild stuff. So some advice that I have for Bainbridge Island School Superintendent Peter Bang Knudsen: stay out of everything. Focus on education. Focus on educating kids. Because this political and social stuff, you suck at it. All right. In a second edition of Unbelievable, State Senator Mark Elias is going after both fringes, or what he claims are both fringes. Let's get to it in another edition of Unbelievable. State Senator Mark Elias, who we've been tough on the show because he pushed through Senate Bill 5599, which is government-sanctioned kidnapping of children, and he called anyone who disagreed with it, including me, transphobes, MAGA, right-wing, lunatics, whatever it is. Well, he is making an old trip to Finland. How nice, right? How nice. I want to be a state lawmaker so I can take some trips to places I've never been. Why is he going to Finland? Well, he talked about this on Twitter, and he shared an article that says traffic deaths are down in Finland. Washington leaders will travel there to find out how. He said the city of Helsinki hasn't had a single traffic fatality this year. I'll be traveling there next month to learn what they're doing and what's working so we here in Washington can work to achieve the same results. Now, Nicole pointed out something when she read this article, which is, do you have to travel to Finland to hear from them what they've changed? Do you have to, what, set foot on the roadway and watch for yourself that traffic fatalities aren't happening? Because one of the things Finland has done is they're a little tougher on drunk driving. The article from the Washington State Standard says, Finland is tough on drunk driving with the legal limit set at 0.05% blood alcohol concentration. Helsinki in the past 3 years installed 70 automatic speed enforcement cameras, which resulted in drivers slowing down. Okay, so do
you... That'll
do it. That'll do it. So do you, Senator Marco Lias, and by the way, Helsinki, Finland is a much different place than Washington State, okay? That's one of the major things, glaring issues we should get out of the way. But do you have to do any, I don't even know, are there Republicans coming on this little excursion to Finland? If there are, I feel the same way. I don't think you actually have to physically go to Finland to have them tell you that they installed 70 speed enforcement cameras and lowered the blood alcohol legal limit to 0.05. Something tells me you just want to go to Finland, which, whatever. But here's the thing that really gets me. In his follow-up tweet, apparently there are a lot of folks who think this trip is a little pointless, as do we. So Marco Lias took to Twitter. He said, I'm excited to visit Finland with colleagues from our state to get inspired to reduce traffic fatalities. Like, first of all,
you need inspiration to save lives.
Don't need inspiration to save lives. Mm-hmm. Apparently, you need just a little getaway to just be inspired. Inspired to keep the state safe. He goes on to say, response from MAGA right and Seattle left has been virulent. So I guess if the extremes hate the idea of learning from others, it must be a great idea. Yeah. Okay.
Like, so, Seattle left is not that extreme.
Yeah, well,
even
is
for,
he calling?
Yeah. Even for Marco.
Well, here's the thing. Marco, I hate to be the one to break this to you, Senator. You are the extremes. Mm-hmm. You are the extremes. You know why you're the extremes? Because you supported, along with your Democratic colleagues, a 2021 suite of legislation that made it nearly impossible for police officers to pull over and stop violent criminals, violent, dangerous criminals, when they flee from law enforcement. And that has resulted directly in deaths on our roadways, multiple deaths on our roadways. So you are supporting extreme policies that have led to an increased number of traffic fatalities here in our state. So rather than travel thousands of miles to be told by a city in Finland about their traffic cameras, maybe you should be a little more introspective and look at some of the very policies that you've supported that have led to more deaths on our streets. But just an idea. Who am I? I'm just a lady with a podcast. All right, I've been talking about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I'm down 35 pounds. I'm feeling so good. This time last year, that was not the case. Although I had just started the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, after seeing some pictures of myself where I couldn't deny it anymore. I couldn't deny that I'd put on 40 pounds during the pandemic. It was as plain as day. And so I embarked on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic journey. In 2 months, I lost almost 30 pounds, and it was really easy for me to stick to, honestly. And the weight's been pretty easy to keep off. And if there's a few days, especially this time of the year where there's holidays and events, where I can go and enjoy myself and I can get right back on the program, and it's so seamless. So if this is something you've been considering because you've been hearing me talk about it, you've been seeing my before and after pictures, or hearing us talk about the success story of other Undivided fans, just give Dr. Ryan Coogan a call, or better yet, schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team. You can do the consultation virtually. In fact, you can do the entire program virtually, even if you live in Helsinki. You can do it from Finland as well if you live there. So Helsinki. Why do I call it Helsinki? Helsinki. Even if you live in Helsinki, you can do the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, no Florida report today. Miranda had a little extended physical therapy thing, although I was kind of bummed because what happened in Florida yesterday?
Oh, the debate. Well, debate and Trump rally and all the drama.
But the debate in Miami, and we were looking forward to Miranda having it on Florida Report, but she had some stuff that was more important going on that I do agree was more important. So I'm sorry, you're stuck with my analysis of some of the key moments of the debate out of Miami. I mean, my overarching analysis is nothing's changing. Nothing's changing. Trump is still the apparent preference, the presumptive nominee. And I just, although I do like this, to have the field whittled down so you don't have this crazy amount of people on stage who are just talking over each other. So I think that the smaller the field gets, the better the debates are in terms of being able to hear from candidates more. But it's still, you know, a holy disaster. So Vivek Ramaswamy. Did I do that right?
I think so.
People are so harsh on my pronunciations. Vivek really was, I think, the star of the show, but not necessarily in a good way. I mean, he definitely had some zingers, and he's a good speaker, but he says some weird stuff. I'm just being honest. But there were a few moments that have been shared a lot on social media, and there were a few that I was like, okay, amen, including he used his opening remarks to go after not only the Republican Party, but also the media, including the moderators of the debate. Here it is.
Why should you be the nominee and not the former president?
I think there's something deeper going on in the Republican Party here, and I am upset about what happened last night. We've become a party of losers at the end of the day. It is a cancer in the Republican establishment. Let's speak the truth. I mean, since Ronna McDaniel took over as chairwoman of the RNC in 2017, we have lost 2018, 2020, 2022, no red wave that never came. We got trounced last night in 2023. And I think that we have to have accountability in our party. For that matter, Ron, if you want to come on stage tonight, you want to look the GOP voters in the eye and tell them you resign, I will turn over my, yield my time to you. And frankly, look, the people there are cheering for losing in the Republican Party. Think about who's moderating this debate. This should be Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan, and Elon Musk. We'd have 10 times the viewership asking questions that GOP primary voters actually care about and bringing more people into our party. You think the Democrats, and we've got Kristen Welker here, you think the Democrats would actually hire Greg Gutfeld to host a Democratic debate? They wouldn't do it. And so the fact of the matter is, I mean, Kristen, I'm going to use this time because this is actually about you in the media and the corrupt media establishment. Ask you, the Trump-Russia collusion hoax that you pushed on this network for years, was that real or was that Hillary Clinton made up disinformation? Answer the question. Go.
Mr. Ross.
Sorry. This is how we get our country back. We need accountability because this media rigged the 2016 election. They rigged the 2020 election with the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Mr. Ramaswamy,
and they're going to rig this election.
Your time is up.
Accountability.
Let me turn to Governor Christie. Why are you?
I mean, I can't argue with him on some of those fronts. It's also a good point about, you know, when he's talking about as Republicans. So it's a good point, and I also have an issue with it. When he's talking about Republicans and would they choose or would Democrats choose like some left-wing or right-wing commentator to do their debates or to host their debates. And the answer is probably not. But at the same time, I disagree with him that the Republican debates are just about appealing to a Republican audience. I understand that the Republican debates are trying to whittle down who is going to be the Republican nominee. But in the process, don't you also want to reach moderates and independents and people who might be swayed to your side? And so, yeah, I do think that the Republican debate process should be about more than just, hey, let's only aim for reaching a Republican audience. I don't think that helps you in the long run. All right. Also, Vivek had some moments that I just sort of cringed at, including sort of just what I would consider bullying.
Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, got a $5 million bribe from Ukraine. That's why we're sending $200 billion back to that same country. The fact of the matter is the Republican Party is not that much better. You have the likes of Nikki Haley, who stepped down from her time at the UN. Bankrupt or in debt was her family. Then she becomes a military contractor. She joins the board of Boeing and otherwise, and is now a multimillionaire. So I think that that's wrong when Republicans do it or Democrats do it. That's the choice we face. Do you want a leader from a different generation who's going to put this country first? Or do you want Dick Cheney in 3-inch heels?
All right, Mr.
In which
Ramaswamy.
Case, we've got two of them on stage
Mr.
tonight.
Ramaswamy, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the Dick Cheney, and what do you say, 2-inch or 3-inch heels? Because everybody's
Three inch heels because of
Ron DeSantis allegedly wears lifts in his cowboy boots, but also it's like, okay, it's just
down stoop.
Well, he's already stooped. It's too late for stooping. Let me see. There was also, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to only play Vivek. I'll play one more clip after this that's not Vivek. But he said something toward the end that I agree with, and we've been saying on the show all the time, is Democrats need to be honest that Joe Biden is not going to be their nominee.
I also want to close with one message to the Democrat Party. End this farce that Joe Biden is going to be your nominee. We know he's not even the president of the United States. He's a puppet for the managerial class. So have the guts to step up and be honest about who you're actually going to put up so we can have an honest debate. Biden should step aside, end his candidacy now, so we can see whether it's Newsom or Michelle Obama or whoever else.
All right,
just tell us the truth so we can have an honest debate.
That's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it doesn't benefit Democrats to show their hand right now, but they do have a plan. There is no way that their plan is Joe Biden. And Gavin Newsom has been showing every single sign that he's trying to position himself. He's protest too much about, oh, no, not me. I'm going to go to China and, you know, go to all these battleground states and I'm going to air political ads in Florida, but not me. And then he's going to be like, well, Joe Biden says he can't do it anymore, so I guess I just have to step up, you know, for the American people. That's what's going to happen. So I think Republicans and everyone else should just proceed with that in mind, that it's not going to be Joe Biden. It's probably going to be Gavin Newsom. All right. One moment that I thought, so Tim Scott, I don't think is going to be on the stage much longer. So
probably not. Did you see he has a girlfriend now, though?
Oh, a new girlfriend as of just the election
cycle?
He's never
been married, and they say that he may never have been in bed with any woman, but he has.
Who says that?
Oh, that's a thing.
Who? Well, they get, no. Who? From that, who?
No, that's he said before he's a virgin because he wouldn't have sex before he got married.
Oh, that's okay, yes. Nicole.
No, I know. So it's exciting that he has a girlfriend that he might be close to marrying.
Oh my God, okay.
It's totally okay.
You know,
I'm just saying.
We just talked about bullying.
I'm not bullying. Okay. I just said I was happy for him.
People are going to be
defending
him.
She's very nice looking lady.
Be nice to Nicole. Who is she? I didn't know this. Now you're springing news on me in the middle of the podcast.
Oh, I'll
okay,
get
fine.
You
yes.
Her.
So anyway, I don't think Tim Scott's going to be on the stage much longer. So we figured we'd play a clip from what I thought was a really good moment from Tim Scott. Lester Holt is clearly trying to get him in a gotcha moment. And Tim Scott just very calmly shuts him down.
Your time is up, but let me just follow up. The idea of pumping gas, of turning on pipelines, that doesn't make gas cheaper that day. I'm talking about you become president. What can you do specifically to help people feel better about their situation or be better with their situation?
Well, actually, it does, to be honest with you. The way that the economy works is it works on the ability to anticipate excess supply versus the demand. When that happens, confidence drives our prices down because we know there's going to be a greater surplus. When you allow for those who have leases to actually start drilling, to start using those leases for more energy excavation, you put our economy in the strongest position. And as a result of that, prices start going down.
Yeah, like when Lester Holt's a smart guy, but he was clearly thinking that Tim Scott would not have a retort to that. He was trying to call Tim Scott as if, you know, his policy position is flimsy. And then Tim Scott very clearly articulated why it was not flimsy. So I thought that was a very good moment.
I also think that, I also think, get back to your comment about having, you know, Fox News anchors anchor or do the debates and things. I actually, I kind of see the benefit of it because it brings out issues that actually makes sense to talk about because there was a lot of foreign stuff to talk about in this and they didn't get to issues that are affecting Americans until pretty far into it. And so I think that somebody from NBC that obviously doesn't like most of these people focusing on issues that don't matter to the American people is part of the problem. And so, yes, having people that are going to focus on things that either mean more to the audience they know is listening or mean more to Americans in general would be helpful.
Yeah. So. Who'd he throw out there? He's like, this debate should be moderated by Tucker Carlson and Joe Rogan. That's why I don't think you have.
I mean, that'd be entertaining.
I would be thoroughly entertained, although Elon Musk is super awkward. I just don't know if he would be a good
debate moderator. It'd be interesting to see
moderator.
Him in the other position, though, because he's always the one being asked questions, and so he always takes that really long pause that's really awkward and weird. But if he was the one asking questions, I wonder what that would be like.
Let's get to questions and comments from the live stream. Lieutenant Dan says, sending love from the hospital, caught COVID and had some... and had some complications. We'll try to stay tuned as long as possible. It sucks. We're sorry.
I know.
Our buddy Lieutenant Dan. Yeah, will you update us? That's awful. You don't want to mess around with anything like that. Andy Stevens, if the council goes moderate, it will get to pick Mosqueda's replacement too. Yeah, so Teresa Mosqueda, who's in one of the citywide positions, she looks like she might win her race for King County Council. So if she does, she said she's going to finish out the year. But then if she ditches to the city council, then you have also on top of all these positions that just went up, you have an open citywide position. So that is interesting as well. All right. Kathy says, having Sawant gone is wonderful, but what she plans to devote her time to is a scary, scary thought. Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, I kind of tend to think that Sawant, she's always been dedicating her time to the National Socialist Movement. I mean, when you really think about it, all the policies that she pushes in Seattle are then part of trying to push those policies at a nationwide level. So at least Seattle isn't going to be sort of her little toy for experimenting on all of these things. But I do think that she has been already trying to push socialist policies as part of a nationwide movement for some time. And that's part of the thing that made her an ineffective, many things, ineffective city councilwoman. She didn't care about her district. And she was a councilwoman elected to represent a district, not a citywide position. And she abandoned them in favor of her political aspirations. All right, Two Ladies Midwest Adventures. Could we actually have schools teach what has happened to USSR, China, Cuba, Venezuela in regard to communism? We need to remember the millions who died. Well, sure, but I think you also, that's another thing, where in today's political climate, it's like one of those issues where, gosh, can you imagine the activist teachers and how they would manipulate that curriculum? That's scary to think about. Some of these things, and I saw someone comment, I think it was on Locals, that maybe, you know, the history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine is just better left to college students, and they can choose electives and decide whether they want to learn about something, and they're not as minds of kids that can be manipulated more easily. I think college kids can still be manipulated, but indoctrinated is the word I was looking for. Bernie Coe says, write a bill to put reading, writing, and basic arithmetic, not the Common Core crap, back in our schools and get CRT out too. I don't think Democrats would support that, but I wonder if Democrats would be willing to oppose a Republican bill that has to do with improving education about the Holocaust. Like, I'd really like to meet the Democrats who are going to vote against that thing. Darla Steele Dowell says, there's no election integrity in Washington state. No checks and balances here. People cast their votes, mail it, and depend on a website to confirm it was received and counted accordingly. Nick Greer says, you think I would trust these rogue teachers to teach my kids about the conflict when they think 2 + 2 does not equal 4? Again, that's a very, very, very good point. All right, on Mark Elias, Lieutenant Dan says, Mark Elias going after both fringes is laughable, especially when he calls concerned parents extreme. That's the thing, is like, this has become just a common theme. It's like, oh, if you disagree with me, then you're fringe. If you disagree with me, then you're an extremist. And you hear it a lot from Democrats. I mean, they call moderate, reasonable people extremists all the time. Look at poor Adam Fortney up in Snohomish County, who Democrats spent a ton of money, the most expensive Snohomish County sheriff's race in history, a ton of money trying to paint as an extremist. So yeah, Mark Elias going after the fringes is just a big old joke. Susie said, I bet they also prosecute offenders when they break the law, which helps maintain those rules that save those lives. Let's see. Brett Hammond says, hopefully he posts some good pics so we can all see how our money was spent. Yeah, in Helsinki. Did anyone correct me on my pronunciation?
Yes, they did.
Oh, God. I realized it halfway through. Helsinki, I'm sorry. You know, I just play a smart person on TV. On the debate, Matthew Cook says, if I failed as much at my job as Ronna McDaniel does at hers, I would have been fired years ago. It is funny to me. How can you paint her as anything but a failure? And look, do I blame her specifically, Ronna McDaniel, for the losses of Republicans like in the 2022 midterms when they should have won handily? No, there's a lot that goes into that. There's only so much you can do about candidate quality, and Trump really kills down ballot Republicans and just the specter of Trump in a lot of races. So that's, but she's also been supportive of Trump. And so I think at some point, if you're not winning when you should be winning and you continue to lose, then yeah, you do need some sort of change in direction when it comes to leadership. All right, wonderful questions and comments on the show today. Per the usual, okay, we have a wonderful closing sanity check for you. But first, I wanted to follow up to a story we talked about on Monday. So you remember Bloomberg? This is actually the subject of one of our subscriber polls on Patreon and Locals. So Bloomberg wrote this article where the headline was, Americans like sharing bad economic news way too much. And the entire premise of the article was, oh no, we're not in rough economic times. There's no recession coming. But if you dummies keep sharing bad economic news, it's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then you're going to thrust us into a recession because you're just not grateful enough for what Bidenomics has done for you. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, it's probably true that I share bad economic news more, but I also don't think that me sharing bad economic news is responsible for the current state of the economy. I think it has to do with printing a lot of money out of nothing and creating an economy that's just a house of cards. So anyway, I told you guys I wanted to ask Zach Abraham about that sentiment because I'll be fair, okay, maybe it does. Maybe sharing bad economic news actually does lead to a worse economy. So we have an expert on the show, so I figured I'd ask him. Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital, we sent the article to him to read and asked him to come on and share his perspective. Zach Abraham, welcome back to Undivided.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always look forward to it.
So are Americans just too obsessed with sharing bad economic news and we're to blame when things actually go south?
No, I think that people that don't make $500,000 to $1 million that live in the real world and have not spent their entire life and career in academic ivory towers that are actually impacted by negative economic news, I think those people like to share it. I think most people like to believe that their professional future and their financial future look good. But call me crazy, right?
Yeah. I mean, is there anything to the assertion that if you have Americans on social media sharing a lot of bad economic news, that it might become a self-fulfilling prophecy and that people will hold off doing certain things that will ultimately hurt the economy?
So this is the funny part about the article. If that was happening, then why is there 4% consumer spending growth, right? I laugh at these articles because they collapse in on themselves. Okay, so let's get down to economic reality, okay? So first of all, when she goes, the economy's strong, there is no recession in sight. Unlike her, we've actually done the work on this, okay? So when you look at the history of recessions, every single time, without exception, you had a blowout GDP and consumer spending report the quarter before you went into recession. And it has to do with the business cycle, meaning when businesses see tough times coming, they liquidate goods at discounted prices. So GDP is like a it's a very rudimentary way to say this, but GDP numbers are like a consolidation of transactions. So we can show that transactions have gone up a lot, but if the businesses were selling them at no profit, therefore selling them at artificially low prices, and the reason businesses do this is really simple. They want to get their capital out of the manufacturing cycle. If you see lower demand right around the corner, you just want to liquidate inventory and get as much capital on the side as possible. So what ends up happening is consumer spending jumps because they're buying things at 30% discounts, right? If they weren't discounted, you wouldn't see a surge in consumer spending. People can get articles in Bloomberg that work for the Federal Reserve and are PhD economists and still have absolutely zero idea what they're talking about. So when she says there's no recession right around the corner, look, she may end up being right. Nobody's got the answer. But what she cites as being the fact, it's ridiculous. When you read articles like this, to me, it really enforces or reinforces one of the biggest problems we have in this country and this economy at large is you have a bunch of people making decisions who are completely insulated and completely detached from what the average consumer and the average person and the average citizen is actually dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's a great point. When I read that headline, I'm like, it's kind of like, oh, woe is you, America. Stop being so negative. Negative Nancy's. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like people are struggling. But, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about okay, if there is a recession, which I hope that there's not, but obviously, but if there is one, what are they going to blame it on in a presidential election year, right? Can you see this being a narrative, which is like, well, yeah, all the right-wing outlets were sharing all this bad news about the economy, and so it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I'm sure that some idiot will do. I mean, we have members of Congress stepping up to podiums and spewing anti-Semitic garbage right now. So I'm sure people will try to spin off any narrative they can. At the end of the day, the reality is somewhat simple. Okay, you spent 15 years stacking up debt to the ceilings on corporations, individuals, government the most, at the lowest interest rates in human history. And it resulted in, and I know this sounds crazy, right? But it resulted in the hottest inflation prints we've seen since the 70s. Okay, so then over the course of 18 months, you went on the highest and fastest rate hiking cycle in history. What do you think's gonna happen? Right, wait, Randy, until you start seeing the defaults. We were looking at, they're starting to come through right now. So you just had an office building in San Francisco that was purchased in 2018 for $66 million. You just had it auctioned off for $15 million. Okay. Wow. For anybody keeping score at home, that's a 75% write down. It's actually almost an 80% write down. You just had a $1.2 billion skyscraper office building in Toronto that literally, it came up for refinance. The owner gave it back to the bank. They haven't even auctioned it off yet. He just walked away from a $1.2 billion building. Okay. These stories are going to come in fast and hard. And here's the other thing. It's really funny to watch her. She really, truthfully, I read that and I'm like, the only part of this makes sense is if she's working on the Biden reelection campaign. Nobody, including me, knows exactly what's going to happen. And anybody that says they do, that's the only person whose opinion we shouldn't listen to. But when you see articles like this, it's not subjective. She's just wrong. The things she's saying are wrong. This economy is not humming. We're looking at architectural billing and new permits for multi-housing and single. They are collapsing. Okay. So, I mean, everywhere we look, you are seeing things going south. So again, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be right, but I would bet a substantial sum that I am, because, you know, this is how it always shakes out.
I think you make a really good point that anyone who claims to know or not know what's coming exactly for sure can't be trusted. And that's how she ends this article. The economy is strong. There's no recession in sight. That's not a question. That's not an equivocation. She is very calm. I'd like to have you and her in a little debate of some kind. I think that would be a lot of fun. Let's set it up.
Hey, you and me both. It just reminds me in 2006 of Ben Bernanke appearing before the House Judiciary Committee and saying that the issues in subprime are contained.
Yeah. You know, Not so much. Zach, no. Abraham, we appreciate it. And you have your final live webinar of the year coming up on November 16th. And so what can folks learn if they join? And it's free to sign up, by the way.
Yeah, just how differently we do things, you know, how we actively manage portfolios and most importantly, in this period of time, manage risk. And, you know, I'll just tell people, we are very conservatively positioned right now. We think you can make 5% risk-free on U.S. government bonds. That's a great deal. There's some other great companies out there that are not really subject to. Anyway, there's a lot of great places to put money right now. It's just not the places that people are thinking about. And we just believe, hey, if the worst story our clients have to tell over the next year and a half is that they could have made more money doing something else, then that's a result we can live with. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the story that a lot of people are telling. So I just think it's a great time to look into our risk management processes and, you know, how we can drastically lower risk while actually increasing your upside return. And we just walk them through how we do it.
Yeah. And again, it's free. And so I think at the very least, you know, getting a little bit of free advice from an expert is a good thing. So Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital, we appreciate your time as always. So keep sharing that bad economic news if you want to, because it has nothing to do with whether the economy is going to go into recession or not. So, and again, if you want to sign up for Zach's webinar, knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. It's coming up on November 16th. All right, doozy of a sanity check, and really something that we want to make sure that we make right, because this slipped under the radar. Democrats got away with it. The election is behind us. It would be easy to forget about it. However, we don't tolerate race baiting on this show. So let's get to it in our closing sanity check. So I talked earlier in the week about a few really bad campaign mailers, a bad campaign ad. Last week, we talked about that a lot as well. And there was one in particular that I had brought up that I had some issues with. It was a Republican ad against State Senator Twyna Nobles, who's running for a school board position, which she won, by the way. But I didn't like just a factual inaccuracy about it. But there was another problem that the Washington State Democratic Senate Democratic Campaign Committee had with it. They claim that that same ad that I discussed, in the same ad, the Washington State Republican Party, which paid for the ad, darkened Twyna Nobles' skin, and they're saying it's racist. They sent out a tweet. This is some time ago now. Again, this was last week, and so the election is over. We could forget about it, but I don't want to forget about it. So the Washington Senate Democrats tweeted, "This attack on Senator Twyna Nobles from the Washington Republicans is disgusting. They darkened her skin tone in this picture. Their blatant anti-blackness is showing." And if you remember last week, I kind of mentioned that that accusation was out there. But what I had said at the time is everyone puts some bad picture of their opponent on there that makes them look dark and evil and red, or, you know, they'll like tint it red. So it's like, ah, oh, don't vote for them. They're the devil. And so I had kind of dismissed this accusation from Senate Democrats that the GOP darkened her skin. But then I got a message from the chair of the Washington Republican Party, and he said, "You know what, Brandy, truth matters, and we didn't touch that picture." He said, "We did not edit that picture at all." I'll give you a side-by-side in a moment. But, you know, his point was, look, I get it that the election is a few days ago, but this is a big accusation to say that we altered a picture of a black woman to make her skin look darker. They're saying that we're racist because of it, and we didn't alter it. And Jim Walsh sent me directly a picture that is still up today on Senator Twyna Nobles' social media that shows the picture that they took for this mailer. You tell me, if you're watching on the podcast, whether they darkened her skin. So on the left is the picture that today is on Twyna Nobles' social media. On the right is the picture that ended up in the campaign mailer. Her skin tone actually looks darker in the version that is up on her own social media. If anything, and I actually think that this is, it's a picture from the exact same moment, but I think it's a slightly different angle because there's a man walking behind her in one of them, it looks like. But you can tell it's like a picture taken almost like just split second apart. And in the mailer, the only difference I see is maybe increased contrast that would have come from just a crappy print job. You know, when you
better, like, it almost looked like a glossy finish.
Right, glossy finish. Like when I made my business cards, I kind of wasn't happy with it. It almost looked like it was adding like weird shadows in places they didn't exist. And that's all this looks like. But her skin tone is actually brighter. Mm-hmm. Her skin is actually brighter in the version of the flyer from the Washington Republican Party. So this tweet, this accusation from Washington Senate Democrats is completely made up out of nowhere. It's completely made up out of nowhere. Who told them? Did they not look at the original picture to compare it? Her skin is not darker. It wasn't darkened by the Washington State Republican Party. And I agree with you, Jim Walsh, who, again, sent me a text message just urging me to be clear and to say that truth matters, facts matters, even though the election is behind us, we did not darken this image. And having now looked at the original image, which is still up on her social media, they did not darken the image. And so I don't know if they have it in them, but the Washington Senate Democratic campaign should apologize and should admit that it made this up out of absolutely nowhere, which is insane. All right, that has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Don't forget to shop our merch store if you haven't already. Get a piece of our Common Sense 2024 collection while you're there, undividedpod.com. And if you have not signed up to support the show yet, you can also do it there, undividedpod.com. It's just $5 a month if you want to support our mission and our movement to give common sense a comeback. God knows we're going to need the support coming into an important election year in 2024. That has been it for the live show this week. If you are a subscriber, we'll see you on the Sunday edition of Sundays with Subscribers. We'll be joined by Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz. See you then.